In 1979, a thriller emerged that would forever change the landscape of spy fiction. Published under the pseudonym Trevenyan, the pen name of academic Rodney Whittaker, Shibumi became an instant cult classic that continues to influence writers and filmmakers today. The novel's protagonist, Nikolai Hell, represents something rarely seen in Western literature, an assassin whose philosophical worldview and pursuit of aesthetic perfection drive the narrative rather than mere plot mechanics. Tom Clancy reportedly kept a dog-eared copy by his desk, while directors like Quentin Tarantino and the Wachowskis have acknowledged its influence on their work. Unlike conventional thrillers that prioritize action over character, Shibumi inverts this formula, creating a meditative exploration of culture, identity, and the pursuit of excellence wrapped in the trappings of an international espionage tale. When Don Winslow was asked to write a prequel, published as Satori in 2011, he admitted the daunting nature of stepping into Trevenyan's world, a testament to the original's enduring power. Born in Shanghai to a Russian aristocrat mother, Nikolai Hell's formative years unfolded against the backdrop of pre-war colonial China. His multilingual upbringing reflected his mother Alexandra Ivanovna's belief that different languages suited different purposes. Love, expressed in French, tragedy in Russian, business in German, and servants addressed in English. Chinese, which he learned from servants' children, became his language of private thought, the one realm his mother couldn't penetrate. While tutors provided his formal education in mathematics, literature, and philosophy, Shanghai's streets offered his true schooling. Disguised in blue clothing and a round cap, young Nikolai witnessed the harsh realities of colonial life. Tuberculosis-ridden rickshaw pullers, exploited young girls, beggars controlled by criminal syndicates, and the brutal treatment of dock workers. These experiences fostered a deep hatred for what he termed the merchant mentality, the exploitation of others for profit without creating anything of value. When the Sino-Japanese conflict erupted in 1937, Shanghai became a battleground. Despite opportunities to evacuate, Alexandra refused to leave her Avenue Jaffra home. During 3 months of fighting, Nikolai continued roaming with street children until witnessing a horrific bombing at department stores that left him traumatized. After Japanese victory, General Kishikawa Takashi was billeted in Alexandra's home. Unlike other men, the general, a widower with samurai heritage who had sacrificed writing ambitions for military duty, remained politely indifferent to Alexandra's charms. Their relationship transformed when the general discovered Nikolai's self-taught interest in Go, the ancient Japanese board game. Despite receiving a 4-stone handicap, the 13-year-old displayed remarkable insight, noting that Go required both mathematical precision and poetic sensibility. Over the next year and a half, they formed a profound, if undemonstrative, relationship. The general finding satisfaction in guiding a quick-minded youth, and Nikolai discovering the father figure he'd never had. After Alexandra's sudden death, the general arranged for Nikolai to live in Japan with his old friend Otake, a renowned Go master. Before departing for combat duty, Kishikawa introduced Nikolai to the concept of Shibumi, great refinement underlying commonplace appearances, an ineffable quality of understated beauty and spiritual tranquility. This concept immediately captivated Nikolai, who instantly adopted Shibumi as his primary goal in life, to become a personality of overwhelming calm, to excel invisibly, without attracting the attention and vengeance of the tyrannical masses. For nearly 5 years, Nikolai lived with Otake of the 7th Dan in a small mountain village, immersed in the study of Go. Within Otake's sprawling household of extended family and apprenticed pupils, Nikolai discovered his rare constellation of talents for Go mastery: abstract schematic thinking, mathematical poetry, and ruthless focus. But Otake soon recognized something even more extraordinary: Nikolai's mystical ability to rest during games, entering a state of profound tranquility before returning fresh-minded. This revelation came when Nikolai, placing stones while gazing into the garden, explained he had been resting, experiencing what Otake recognized as mysticism. Nikolai described these experiences as departing without leaving, flowing into and understanding all things. During these states, he could still function normally while experiencing timeless unity with everything around him. These experiences came naturally to him 2 or 3 times daily, beginning with flowing motion that brought him to a triangular meadow where he expanded beyond himself, becoming one with everything except animals. Despite the war's increasing pressures, production quotas, reduced consumer goods, fewer Go tournaments, life in the remote village continued. Occasionally, the conflict touched them directly. Otake's middle son was ridiculed for wearing mittens during outdoor exercises, and Nikolai sometimes overheard himself described as a mistrusted foreigner. Yet his German-Russian parentage, carefully arranged in his papers by General Kishikawa, and Otake's respected status protected him from serious discrimination. 3 things dominated Nikolai's formative years: his improving Go game, his mystical retreats, and, during his 17th year, his first love. Mariko, a shy disciple of Otake whose game was intricate but lacked mental toughness, became Nikolai's practice partner. Their mutual reserve made them comfortable together, sharing garden evenings and occasional village errands. Their romance progressed tentatively, from accidental brushes to hand-holding during games to stolen kisses. When Nikolai was nearly 18, he dared visit Mariko's sleeping room, their lovemaking bungling, tentative, infinitely gentle amid the constant fear of discovery. As the tide turned against Japan, evidence of defeat was everywhere. Hysterical propaganda broadcasts, refugee reports of devastating carpet bombing, and increasing shortages. Even in their rural village, food grew scarce, with the Otake family often subsisting on bland vegetable gruel. Though refugees were initially welcomed with compassion, they eventually became burdens referred to as sokaijin, urban drones unable to work for their keep. These experiences came naturally to him 2 or 3 times daily, beginning with flowing motion that brought him to a triangular meadow where he expanded beyond himself, becoming one with everything except animals. Late in the war, General Kishikawa made his final visit, arriving unannounced to invite Nikolai to view cherry blossoms along the Kajikawa River. Their journey took them through devastated landscapes, evidence of the March 9th firebombing that had turned 16 square miles of Tokyo into an inferno. During their conversations among falling cherry blossoms, the general offered profound wisdom about culture and race. "Race is nothing, culture is everything," he explained, cautioning that mixing cultures always results in a blend of the worst elements. While acknowledging American brutality, he counseled Nikolai against simple hatred. "You must seek to understand him, if only to avoid being harmed by him." On their final evening together, the general revealed he had been transferred to Manchukuo and intended to perform seppuku rather than face capture by Russians. "A discredited, defeated old soldier would be no shield for you," he explained, asking Nikolai's permission to depart. Nikolai responded with simple dignity, "Your guidance, your affection will always be with me. In that way, you can never leave me." As Otake-san's stomach cancer worsened, he summoned Nikolai for a final private conversation. Speaking in terms of Go, as was his habit for important matters, he offered both praise and criticism. "You are a brilliant player," he acknowledged, "but there is something distressing in your play, something abstract and unkind. It has the beauty of a crystal, but lacks the beauty of a blossom." The dying teacher identified Nikolai's greatest flaw, his disdain for mediocrity. "Your defeats will not come from those more brilliant than you. They will come from the patient, the plodding, the mediocre." Echoing Kishikawa's warnings, he cautioned, "We are in the age of the mediocre man. He is dull, colorless, boring, but inevitably victorious." His advice was simple: avoid contact with them, camouflage yourself with politeness, live apart, and study shibumi. After sharing this wisdom and a small personal secret about his mint drops, Otake-san concluded their final lesson. After Otake-san's cremation, his family and students dispersed. Nikolai, now over 20, though looking much younger, received money General Kishikawa had left for him and experienced that thrilling social vertigo that accompanies total freedom in a context of pointlessness. On August 3, 1945, the Otake household gathered at the train platform with their belongings. Nikolai promised Mariko he would visit her once he established himself in Tokyo, looking forward to seeing her in her home city of Hiroshima. Post-war Japan was in shambles while American occupiers focused on spreading democracy rather than addressing physical suffering. Nikolai, now destitute, joined the masses of homeless wandering Tokyo streets. His money, worthless from inflation, he failed to find work with Japanese laborers who mistrusted him and had no country to claim assistance from. Through a chance encounter with an Australian officer, Nikolai secured a position as a translator for the occupation forces. His facility with languages, he spoke seven fluently, made him valuable in diplomatic settings, where he learned that, in diplomacy, the principal function of communication is to mask meaning. He later transferred to the cryptography section after impressing them by decoding a message that baffled their machines, one written in Russian with Chinese word order. During this period, Nikolai developed his understanding of Americans, reaching an emotional truce with them despite never truly liking them. He found them culturally immature, materialistic, historically myopic and tiresome, yet good-hearted and hospitable. His key insight was that all Americans were essentially merchants. Their core genius was buying and selling. They sold democracy like hucksters. Their wars were exercises in production. Their government, a series of contracts. Their marriages, emotional deals easily broken. Honor for them meant fair trading, and their only real class was mercantile, with the elite distinguished merely by wealth. Monthly letters with Otake-san's widow confirmed Mariko's death at Hiroshima. Though initially filled with hatred toward the Americans he worked with, Nikolai purged himself of these emotions, spending a day wandering the streets remembering Mariko, their intimacy, jokes, and unions, before gently saying goodbye. His life took a dramatic turn when he discovered, while decoding routine Soviet messages, that General Kishikawa was being flown to Tokyo by the Russians to face trial as a Class A war criminal. After a nightmarish week battling bureaucracy and red tape, Nikolai secured a brief interview with the general at Sugamo Prison. Using Go terminology as code, he explained his intention to free the general through death, a sabaki, or quick, flexible solution. With gentle words about cherry blossoms and memories, Nikolai guided Kishikawa to turn toward the window. As the general nodded his acceptance, Nikolai struck with a pencil, killing him instantly. Arrested immediately, Nikolai was brutally beaten during interrogation by American intelligence officers. 3 years later, a CIA agent approached him with an offer, freedom in exchange for performing an assassination in China. Refusing their inadequate terms, Nikolai demanded Costa Rican citizenship, $100,000, and the addresses of the three men who had interrogated him. Though initially reluctant, the CIA ultimately agreed out of necessity. After completing his mission in China, Nikolai emerged as the world's most sought-after counter-terrorist operative. Over two decades, he worked for various governments against terrorist groups worldwide, commanding fees of $250,000 per assignment. His methods were remarkable, using everything from conventional weapons to ordinary objects like combs, drinking straws, and light bulbs as lethal weapons. Governments willingly paid his exorbitant fees because terrorism was an economically devastating form of warfare, making his services a bargain compared to the alternatives. Interestingly, Hell occasionally worked without payment for causes he believed in, including Jewish militant groups and Basque nationalists who protected his chateau in the Pyrenees. He priced his stunts like movie stuntmen do, based on difficulty and danger. Jobs requiring difficult access or penetration commanded higher fees, while targets with incompetent security, like the IRA or CIA, warranted lower prices. His final job before retirement involved extracting someone from communist China, for which he accepted payment not in money, but in the 2-year services of Hana, an exceptionally trained concubine from the Orphanage of the Passion, a Christian-fronted training academy for high-end companions. Despite his successful career, Hell wasn't excessively wealthy. His operations required expensive setups, particularly when neutralizing governments through blackmail information purchased from the mysterious information broker known as the Gnome. He spent lavishly on caving expeditions and had invested over $2 million restoring his chateau to 18th century authenticity, with no electricity or modern conveniences except an underground telephone line. Having left Japan permanently after finding its traditional ways corrupted by Americanism, he created his own isolated world of Shibumi in the Basque Mountains. His chateau featured a meticulously cultivated Japanese garden, a concrete statement of Shibumi that represented the most important of his possessions. Working in it brought him both peace and purpose as he trimmed and controlled, striving for modest and subtle effects. Seeking escape from the world's complexities, Nikolai discovered caving through his Japanese co-workers. His lithe body was ideal for tight passages, and the mental calculations matched his Go training. Most appealing were the primal fears he confronted alone: darkness, falling, cold, flooding, and tons of rock overhead, with no audience for his victories over these inner demons. With his Basque friend Leka Go, a bombastic poet with a tragic past, Hell explored the Gufra Port de la Ro, a cave system accidentally discovered when young Basque separatists moved boundary stones to place the entrance fully within France. After setting up their winch system with minimal weight cable, they began the dangerous work of clearing the shaft, taking turns descending to break up rock jams and widen bottlenecks. At meter 365, they encountered their worst obstacle, a thick jam beneath a constant icy waterfall with the roar of an underground river below. After Hell nearly succumbed to hypothermia, Leka Go took his turn, breaking through the jam but breaking his arm in the process. When Leka Go's strength failed during the ascent at the most difficult section, a double dihedron at meter 44, Hell deliberately provoked him by suggesting Basques were Neanderthals, inferior to higher Cro-Magnon descendants. Enraged, Leka Go summoned superhuman strength to complete the climb before collapsing unconscious. Their exploration revealed a potentially navigable underground river passage they planned to explore on a future expedition with scuba gear. The dye test from their cave exploration had shown the underground water emerging at the gorge 8 minutes after release, suggesting exciting possibilities for future adventures. Hell's peaceful retirement is shattered when Hannah Stern, the niece of his old friend Asa, arrives at his chateau seeking help. She is the sole survivor of the Munich Five, her uncle's amateur revenge cell targeting the Munich Olympics terrorists. Her companions were gunned down at Rome Airport while she escaped unharmed, eventually making her way to Hell's remote estate. Through careful questioning, Hell determines she wasn't specifically targeted and notes that the Japanese gunmen who killed her friends were themselves quickly eliminated, suggesting a complex operation where the tip-off was tipped off. He theorizes that the PLO, or Black Septemberists, had learned of their plans through untrustworthy IRA contacts. More significantly, he suspects the Japanese gunmen weren't actually Red Army members, but CIA operatives, controlled by what he calls the Mother Company, an international consortium of oil and energy companies that functioned as an infra-government with no loyalty except to profit. Shortly after Hannah's arrival, Diamond, a CIA agent with a personal vendetta against Hell for killing his brother, appears at the chateau with his associates. They reveal the Mother Company's threats. They have seized Hell's Wyoming land holdings and Swiss accounts containing $1.5 million in gold bullion. The land would be strip-mined regardless, but the money would be returned if Hell allowed the Black September terrorists to complete their planned London hijacking. When Hannah decides to abandon her mission and return home after experiencing a mystical moment in Hell's garden, he takes her to his remote mountain lodge for safety. However, she is murdered while picking wildflowers, shot multiple times by Diamond and his associates. Realizing the mother company killed Hannah to prevent him from fulfilling his debt to her uncle, Hell begins planning his response. With the help of Le Cagu and Sir Wilfred Pyles, a British intelligence officer, Hell executes a daring plan to eliminate the PLO terrorists aboard the Concorde. Disguised as a flight attendant, he systematically eliminates five terrorists using improvised weapons, a comb, a rolled magazine, and a creased plastic cup. After completing his mission, Hell returns home to find his beloved chateau destroyed by the mother company's operatives. Though Hannah survived the attack, her eyes were severely injured. Leveraging compromising information about the Kennedy assassination provided by his dying friend Maurice de la Hanse, Hell forces a meeting with the mother company in New York. There, he meets Mrs. Perkins, a matronly woman who insists everyone call her Ma, despite being the ruthless head of the organization. Hell presents his demands: return of his Wyoming land, cessation of strip mining, restoration of his Swiss account, $6 million to rebuild his home, and personal revenge. He wants Diamond and his associates delivered to him. In the misty mountains near the Gouffre Pierre Saint-Martin, Hell exacts his revenge on Diamond, Star, and Heyman. After luring them to a plateau surrounded by dangerous gouffres, deep pits, he eliminates them one by one, though he momentarily considers sparing Diamond before remembering the environmental destruction wrought by the mother company. Back at his partially rebuilt chateau, Hell makes a final decision. He realizes the mother company will eventually discover his deception or uncover the Kennedy assassination facts. Though he could continue fighting, cutting off many arms of the faceless corporate Hydra, they would ultimately kill him. Accepting the inevitable, Hell decides to live peacefully with Hannah until they come for him, at which point he will withdraw from the game voluntarily by his own hand. With this decision made, years of accumulated disgust and hate melt away as, once severed from the future, the past becomes an insignificant parade of trivial events. Late into the night, Hell kneels before his lacquered table holding two treasures, the Go Bowls from Kishikawa-san and the yellowed letter of official regret from Shimbashi Station. Along with the idea of his garden in his mind, these three spiritual sea anchors have sustained him through his years wandering in the West. Throughout the novel, Shibumi emerges not merely as an aesthetic concept, but as a comprehensive life philosophy. When General Kishikawa first introduces Nikolai to the idea, he describes it as great refinement underlying commonplace appearances, an ineffable quality of understated beauty, elegant simplicity, and spiritual tranquility without passivity. This concept immediately captivates the young Nikolai, who adopts Shibumi as his primary goal in life, to become a personality of overwhelming calm, to excel invisibly, without attracting the attention and vengeance of the tyrannical masses. To the general, Shibumi was a kind of submission. To Nikolai, it was a kind of power. Hell's pursuit of Shibumi manifests in various aspects of his life. His chateau in the Basque Mountains, restored to 18th century authenticity with no electricity or modern conveniences, represents a rejection of superficial modernity. His Japanese garden, a concrete statement of Shibumi, embodies the qualities that separate Japanese art from Western dynamics and Chinese hyperbole: sweet melancholy, forgiving sadness, intentional imperfection, and organic simplicity that creates and satisfies aesthetic tensions. Even Hell's approach to sexuality reflects this philosophy. Having progressed through what he identifies as the four stages of sexual development, from amateur beginnings with Mariko, through stage one's healthy animal curiosity with the Tanaka sisters, past stage 2, psychological relief, through stage 3's gourmandizing, the highest most Westerners reach, he arrives at stage 4's refined game phase, where excitation and climax become merely terminal gestures in an activity demanding mental vigor, training, and endurance. Perhaps most significantly, Hell's mystical experiences, his ability to rest during intense concentration, represent the ultimate expression of Shibumi. These moments of oneness with the universe, of departing without leaving, allow him to transcend the limitations of individual existence and experience a profound connection with everything around him. Ironically, it is the loss of this mystical gift, blocked by his hatred after General Kishikawa's death, that marks Hell's greatest spiritual wound. Though he achieves extraordinary success as an assassin and amasses considerable wealth, this spiritual amputation haunts him throughout his life. Only in the novel's final pages, as he accepts his inevitable fate and relinquishes his hatred, does Hell approach the true Shibumi that has eluded him for so long, the ability to face death with calm acceptance and find beauty in impermanence, like cherry blossoms falling in the wind. One of the novel's most enduring themes is its critique of what Otake-san calls the age of the mediocre man. In his final lesson to Nikolai, the dying Go Master warns, "Your defeats will not come from those more brilliant than you. They will come from the patient, the plodding, the mediocre." He describes this mediocre man as dull, colorless, boring, but inevitably victorious. This prophecy proves accurate throughout Hell's life. His greatest enemies are not brilliant adversaries, but institutions and bureaucracies, the CIA, the mother company, governments driven by profit rather than principle. These entities, composed of mediocre individuals following procedures rather than exercising judgment, pose the greatest threat precisely because they lack the imagination to recognize their own limitations. Hell's critique of American culture stems from this same observation. He views Americans as essentially merchants whose core genius is buying and selling. They sell democracy like hucksters, their wars are exercises in production, their government a series of contracts, their marriages emotional deals easily broken. Honor for them means fair trading, and their only real class is mercantile, with the elite distinguished merely by wealth. This critique extends beyond Americans to what Hell sees as the fundamental problem of modern civilization, the triumph of commerce over culture. He respects farmers, artisans, artists, warriors, scholars, and priests, but feels only disdain for merchants who collect power and wealth out of proportion to discrimination and are responsible for kitsch and consumption without use. The Mother Company, an international consortium of oil and energy companies that functions as an infra-government with no loyalty except to profit, represents the ultimate expression of this mediocrity triumphant. Its leader, Mrs. Perkins, with her grandmotherly appearance masking ruthless calculation, embodies the banality of evil that Hannah Arendt identified in her study of Adolf Eichmann. In the novel's final confrontation, Hell realizes the futility of fighting against this hydra-headed mediocrity. Though he could continue cutting off many arms of the faceless corporate hydra, they would ultimately kill him through impersonal means, like a bomb or stray bullet. His decision to withdraw from the game voluntarily by his own hand represents not surrender, but a final assertion of individual dignity against the crushing weight of institutional mediocrity. In this way, Trevanion's novel offers a prophetic warning about the direction of modern civilization, a world increasingly dominated by corporate interests where profit trumps principle and where the mediocre many inevitably triumph over the exceptional few. Yet, it also suggests a response. The cultivation of Shibumi, a personal aesthetic and ethical stance that allows one to maintain dignity and purpose even in a world that no longer values such qualities.